I literally had pain from head to toe, had no idea what was causing it, had no central point person or practitioner that was able to help me understand the connection. So in my mind, I just had like a dozen disparate injuries.
Yeah, you were Humpty Dumpty. I have never heard that reference, and it's perfect.
Yeah, because every time you try to solve one thing, another one tacks on.
Yeah, when you're not treating the right thing, for sure. Yeah.
Welcome to Our Power is Within podcast. I'm your host, Chaz Smith, and my mission for this podcast is to inspire you to take your power back, to realize that you are the healer that you have been looking for all along. I believe that we are all capable of healing in mind, in body, and in soul. If you are new to this podcast, welcome. Thank you for being here. And if you've been tuned in for a while now, welcome. Thank you for being here too. If you've been finding value in this podcast for quite some time, there are a few ways that you can support this podcast. You could leave a 5-star review on either my website, which is ourpowerswithin.com, or Apple. You could also share your favorite episode on social media and tag me, or you could leave a small donation by clicking the link in the podcast show notes called Support This Podcast. Thank you. Thank you. So this week, I am actually doing something totally different and fun. Actually, if I'm being honest, we're going to stick with this theme for about a month. Maybe. We'll see. I might surprise you. To be determined. But on any account, I have decided that since there are so many wonderful resources out there for everybody in the healing community and other wonderful podcasts and podcast hosts, I want to take some time to celebrate them and share them with you. That way, you have even more options for inspiration and education on all things self-healing. So this week, in honor of this, we are celebrating Jennifer Johnson's video podcast, Thought by Thought Healing. Jennifer is a chronic pain coach who hosts a weekly podcast and YouTube channel where she interviews experts in mind-body medicine, shares other healing stories, and talks about her own story through a Christian lens after healing from years of chronic pain that stole her life away. Please enjoy and don't forget to go click subscribe on Jennifer's Thought by Thought YouTube channel today.
In this episode, we are going to talk about things like pressure and how that can turn into chronic pain and how to work with the pressures of culture and our inner pressures. We talk about what pain reprocessing therapy entails. We talk about the Boulder back pain study that she was a part of, a big part of, and 3 tools to remain pain-free. So I'm going to read you a short bio on her, and then we'll get to the interview. Christy Wiepe is a psychotherapist specializing in the treatment of chronic pain, anxiety, and depression, and the founder of the Better Mind Center. Christy has been a key collaborator on the development and the research of the pain reprocessing therapy treatment modality. She lectures nationally on psychotherapeutic interventions to treat chronic pain and is committed to cross-disciplinary collaboration between mental health and physical medicine. Christy is also a recovered chronic pain patient herself. The healing process was so profoundly transformational for the quality of life for her that she has dedicated her career to supporting others through their recoveries. So I hope you enjoy, like it, share it, subscribe if it's helpful. Thanks, guys. Bye. Christy, thank you so much for being here today. I have been very much so looking forward to just talking with you in this and having this conversation. So thanks so much for showing up.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for inviting me. I've been looking forward to it as well.
Awesome. Okay. So let's just start by you telling us a little bit about who you are and your story of healing and where you find yourself kind of today.
Love to. So I'll start with the present and then back up.
Okay.
My name is Christy. I'm a psychotherapist specializing in chronic pain, anxiety, and depression. I have a team of other fantastic clinicians who do the same, but I started off as a chronic pain person. I mean, I still identify as a chronic pain person in many ways, as a mind-body person. I had tons of pain. I usually say it was like head, shoulders, knees, and toes. It just started feeling like Humpty Dumpty. I think a lot of people, when they look back on their pain story, can relate to this. Like, there might be one incident, and I can share mine, that really sparked the throes of my pain journey. But when I look back, like, I was kind of always a sickish kid. Like, I can remember all kinds of symptoms that would come and go that I didn't necessarily seek treatment for when I was much younger. And through high school, I was super anxious, but I would not have used that word. That language was not, was French to me. So I, looking back, I think it was building for a really long time.
Yeah. Yep. I can resonate with that.
Right. And it's interesting the way that it presents in childhood compared to adulthood. But there are some nuances there. It's not always strict pain, but you can tell, like, your nervous system and your immune system are working a little bit too hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But there was one incident that really set it off for me. So in undergraduate, I went to USC twice. So I went there for my undergraduate studies and my graduate studies. And when I was in undergrad, I did have knee pain. But when you have one symptom and it was only triggered by movement, I wasn't doing a ton of treatment for it. I would rest. I thought it was exercise induced. It's just tracking. Like, there's something wrong with my knees. But there was a gap year that I had in between undergrad and grad school. And I took a gap year because I couldn't quite figure out what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to do grad school of some sort. Wasn't sure when I wanted to start. I was, like, really stressed out coming out of undergrad because I ran very stressed out as a person. And I went to the gym to just get a workout in. And I was trying to do, I don't know who I thought I was this day, because I'm, like, not particularly flexible. And I tried to stretch into a split, like, slowly.
Okay.
And I just, I fell into it. Like, it was not slowly at all. And I just kind of forced my legs into a, I did get to a split technically, but I literally tore my, what's the word? I tore my hamstring. There was a more specific spot. I always say I broke my butt. It felt like I broke my butt. It just, like, ripped the hamstring muscle off my butt bone.
Okay.
Which was, like, an extremely painful acute injury.
Yeah.
Definitely needed medical treatment. It hurt a lot.
Did you say that you did get into the split position, or you
did? Yes, I did. And there was moment where I was, like, in excruciating pain, but I was also so impressed that I got down there. I was like, well, I am here. I have accomplished something. It just took me ripping my butt muscle off of its bone to get there.
Ripping your body apart to make your goals come true. Got it. Okay.
that would be the title of my memoir from this period.
Yeah.
So I really hurt myself, but because I was in such a accumulation of anxiety and stress, both over my lifetime and in this period where I was literally in a gap between what I want to do with my life and do I want to stay in Los Angeles? I'm from the East Coast. What's my next move? So I injured myself during a time of such intense fear and stress that the injury technically healed after about 3 to 6 months.
Yep.
And my pain was worse on my day of treatment graduation or what have you than it was the day that I injured myself.
Okay.
So once that began, and you never really know how much you need your butt until you can't really use it. It's like, I couldn't sit. I couldn't drive. I had to rearrange my entire life to be horizontal. Essentially, I had to lie down a lot. So it's attempting to keep this little job that I had in my gap year. I was attempting to, like, stay as engaged in my life as I could, but I really couldn't sit, walk, or stand. Like, unless I was lying down, I was in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what was going on because all of my doctors were telling me your injury has healed. And then that's when this kind of strange messaging started in, like, maybe you're just really prone to injury, or Maybe your muscles are weaker than most people's, or maybe your body is older internally than your age. I had one doctor tell me, you are, your body is twice as old as you are. And I was like, okay, so I'm 22. So my body's 44. So when I'm 44, it's going to be like I'm 88. I was like, this is not a good trajectory. And so the stress was mounting there.
Yeah.
And then that's when Humpty Dumpty syndrome set in. It was like my neck started hurting the next year. My head started hurting a few weeks after that. That turned into vertigo. I had bilateral wrist pain. My knee pain had never gone away. That original thing that I had kind of kept an eye on through undergraduate.
Oh, right.
And then it was just full blown. I literally had pain from head to toe. Had no idea what was causing it, had no central point person or practitioner that was able to help me understand the connection. So in my mind, I just had like a dozen disparate injuries.
Yeah, you were Humpty Dumpty. I have never heard that reference and it's perfect.
Yeah. Because every time you try to solve one thing, another one tacks on.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're not treating the right thing, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here you are, you're in this, you're just living your life, what you think is normal life, except for that you've been told your body is just a disaster, which is outside of your control. So I assume you're just coping at this point in time.
Just coping the best I could, but it took a huge hit on my relationship to myself, to my relationships with friends. It was difficult to explain what I was going through because I looked the same. And this was all during this period of what was meant to be a pause year for me, a chance to bring my stress level down, to get my bearings, to know what to do. But I ran out the clock on that year. And I had decided somewhere in this, I am going to go to grad school. I'm going to go back to USC to get my master's in social work. And I began that journey with all of those pain symptoms. I started day one with all these different, I look like a bionic woman. I had braces on my knees, both my wrists. I had a little heating pad that I'd wear on my neck. I had a little pillow that I'd carry around to put on my, first of all, the desks in college campuses are designed for 7-year-olds. So there's even someone without pain is not comfortable in those desks, but it was miserable to me. So I started off in that much pain. And again, the stress level was just going up and up and up. So that program is a 2-year program. That first year was spent in horrific pain. Trying lots of different types of treatments. None of them were really making sense. But going into my second year of grad school, and I had put enough together to recognize there has to be something about my stress level that's at least making the pain worse. I wasn't understanding it as causal, but I was seeing it as a correlate.
Yeah. It's a big difference.
Big difference. It opened my mind to it, but I still was not confident that there was a way to be out of pain, but I was curious about a way to lower my pain.
Yes.
And that second year of grad school, just through luck and serendipity, and I'm so grateful for this, I met Alan Gordon, who works at USC. And Alan Gordon is the director of the Pain Psychology Center. He really spearheaded pain reprocessing therapy, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. And he met me, he was like, what's happening? Because he could see physically all of these like braces that I had on or what have you. And he introduced me to the world of mind-body healing, opened the door for me, gave me my first Sarno book. And it was just off to the races from that point. It clicked really, really, really fast. I felt super warm and receptive to the idea. I had a ton of support in terms of getting the resources. Once that door was finally opened, it was like kind of a deluge of positive information, and things started coming back together really quickly for me.
And we just go back one second. What you talked about with the importance of recognizing that the emotions or the stress is causal. I think that's so important to recognize that it's the cause of it and therefore what we're targeting. Because I remember in my own journey, and I've forgotten about this until you said it, that at one point in time, I recognized, this is related to how I respond to stress, or this is related to stress. And I remember just sobbing and telling a friend, I broke myself because of my inability to handle emotions in my life. I broke my emotional system. And so I mean, that's such a judgmental thing to do to yourself, to think I caused all this and I ruined myself. But to realize it's not being influenced by my stress level. It is caused by it. And therefore I can adapt and I can reverse this and change this. It gives you the power back to realize it's not just the cause, it's the cure too. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a lot of people relate to that initial resistance and difficulty with accepting that, exploring the idea of stress as causal because of this overwhelming recognition. Did I do this? What was I missing this whole time? How did I get to this point? Like, it's so severe and debilitating. And it's tough when our brain takes us down that path. It's just an unbelievable lack of information in the medical field. A lot of us are open to it once the information is given to us, but we're not presented with the information, coupled with likely an emotional toolkit that was missing some pretty important pieces. Neither of those things are our fault. We can eventually take responsibility for them,
right,
but they're not our doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you're creating a connection with Alan. He's opening your eyes to all this stuff. And what was that journey like for you?
So the summer before I started the clinical internship, I did a clinical internship with him, my second year, my final year at that grad program. I was reading the books. I was reading all the books we read, right? The Sarno book, the Schubiner book, all of it was clicking really fast. So by the time I started my clinical internship, just the knowledge, and I feel really lucky, I know this isn't the case for everyone, just the knowledge of what was going in my body probably reduced my symptoms by about 70%.
Yeah. Okay.
And for anyone listening, I cannot emphasize this enough. That is not the case for most people in the self-recovery space. I had a lot of resources on my side. I had a lot of luck and privilege and support and things that allowed me to work through my relationship with fear in a way that I think was smoother than, I don't want to draw comparisons. I felt lucky. And I, for anyone listening, I cannot emphasize enough, that is not always the case. And if having the knowledge of what's going on in your body does not create symptom reduction, you are, in the vast majority of cases, that's okay. It's workable. It's just a starting place.
Right.
For me, it was really powerful. And again, I literally was working at the Pain Psychology Center with a pioneer in this field. So could I be more lucky? No. That's right. Another reason why some of that was really smooth. But the remaining 30% of symptom reduction that I was working through, I was actually doing while I was actively learning to treat patients from the same perspective. So it's just wild year of a lot of growth curves, a little bit of imposter syndrome, but it was a neat space for me because everything that I was using with my clients, I was using for myself. So it felt like double the exposure, double the practice.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it was through that final 30% of symptom reduction where I did a lot of my self-compassion work, let's say, like understanding the connection, not just back to that knee pain that I had in undergraduate or that injury that I had when I was going into grad school, but all the way back to, oh, I have been relating to my nervous system in an incredibly intense and harsh way for as long as I can remember. And until that shift, there is always going to be another symptom. It will just iterate and iterate and iterate. And that's
Can you unpack that for the listeners? Like, this idea, you've been relating to your nervous system in this harsh way for so long. For most people, what does that mean?
I was mean to myself. I was harsh with myself. I treated myself with a level of intensity that I don't think anyone deserves. I never said no. I said yes to everything, anything. I did not know what a boundary was. I had no upper limit to my productivity threshold. So I would push myself at the pace through, like, this is crazy to think back on, but if I, and this is true, like if I were at the grocery store, or if I were even in my home and I was had the opportunity to run instead of walk, like if no one was watching at the grocery store, yes, and I was like, well, I need to get to the end of the aisle, I'm not kidding, I would literally just start running because I could. It's like, well, I could move faster so I don't die. And that was the same thing that was happening to me internally, this idea of move faster, do more, keep going. Yeah, and yes. There's just, I had no connection to what my nervous system felt like. So I had no upper limit. Like there was no, when I would say no, when my body broke, when I was like crying on the floor in pain, no, I'd still say yes to things. I was still saying, sure, I'll take on more clients, or still, sure, I'll, whatever it was. So recognizing that the pressure I was putting on myself, the expectations that I had of myself, the way that my entire compass was built around doing, performing, and completing, that all had to get dismantled for me to start building my compass, my internal compass, the compass of my nervous system, back around prioritizing my well-being, being in touch with what my body was feeling like on a moment-to-moment basis, being in touch with what it felt like to speak to myself in those intense ways, being in touch with what it felt like to have those standards of myself.
Yeah.
That was where the bulk of my work was.
Yeah. That self-pressure that we put on ourselves. We get that from so many places, right? But where do you see it primarily? Do you see it in like external source of the family, or do you see it in culture and just this driven culture that we live in, that the more we do, the more we're seen, the more we perform, the more valuable we are? Let's just ask this: in your patients, do you find that mostly from that sort of external source, or or from family pressure?
I love that question, and that you're identifying both places. I would say the culture piece, the toxicity of our culture and the productivity focus that we have, at least in a lot of parts of the States, and a lot of places worldwide, that's so strong that I would say it takes an active force in your family or within your community system working against that for you to not be negatively impacted, because it's the current. That's where the stream is going.
Yeah.
So I would say it can be worsened if within your family unit, you also have people who kind of trend towards intensity. But in the absence of someone really buffering you from that, which is not like, that's not nothing. Like that's someone in your life who's kind of already taken the steps to have intentionality around slowing down.
Yep.
In the absence of that, I think by and large, people are going to be impacted by the going, by the doing.
Yeah. I'm just wanting to ask you all sorts of questions. How has that been for you in the Better Mind Clinic? Is it clinic? Better Mind Clinic?
Better Mind Center.
Center. Okay.
Yeah.
How has that been for you balancing that pressure? Because you're
creating something wild.
Amazing and so good, and we need it. And yet, I think I'm part asking because I've had this struggle too of like, okay, I'm starting something, and then keeping that perfectionism a little bit at bay. And this, how's that been for you?
I would say it's been ongoing. It's something I continue to work on, and my body hasn't stopped talking to me.
Yeah.
So we, as a group, do. The other clinicians on my team, we work to have specific meetings where we are checking in on each other's nervous systems, just having a pause and saying, what's coming up? What's coming up for you in terms of your caseload? What's coming up for you with just sitting with other people who are in intensity or in pain? So we work to have a conversation around the impact of this work in general on our systems. By and large, people who are in this field are prone to this same types of sensitivities that lead to the development of chronic pain. So we need to be careful with healing space. And then also apart from just the impact of sitting with people who are walking through this themselves, there's also the impact, and you were speaking to this, of there's no end to the work. Like, there's millions of people suffering from chronic pain. So we could both think we could talk for hours and we would never run out of ideas in terms of where else can we go with this? Who else can we help? How else can we help? How else can we iterate? And it's a balance for me, and it's an ongoing practice of letting that feel exciting, letting that feel even buzzy in my system in some ways. Like, I am drawn to that. I enjoy the rev and the pull.
Yeah.
And then making that commitment over and over again, not to abandon my connection with myself and my body, and to listen. If I don't listen, my body will get louder every single time. And I'm grateful for that. it's a sharp system. If I start having some tension in my shoulder and I ignore it, it will grow. It will grow. It will grow. It will grow into my neck. It will grow into my head. It will grow into vertigo. Like, my body won't abandon me.
Yeah. So sure won't. It's got your back for sure.
It's got my back.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of listening. It's better for me to listen when the murmurs are quiet, because my body knows how to get loud, and it will.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it. Thank you. Thank you for answering that question.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough.
I think part of the reason I just asked that is because, both your listeners and my listeners are on this journey, and it can be so, I think it can become disheartening when your body keeps talking to you, and you feel like, oh, well, if my body's talking to me, that means that I've failed. I'm doing this journey wrong. And in reality, it's not. It's talking to you and helping us to do this in a healthy way that's really fulfilling for me, which ends up being fulfilling for the other people around me also. And we're having to battle that message we're getting from culture. Mm-hmm. And I think even from people who love us, who are part of that stream, like you're talking about. And so we're getting very personal messages in our own lives. So to take heart and know that this is the journey we're on. We're in it.
Right.
We're all experiencing it. You, me, and everybody listening.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And people may have different opinions on this. This might feel disempowering to some and empowering to others, but for me, I've accepted a long time ago, my nervous system is always going to be sensitive. I'm always going to be the person, if something startles me, like if someone pops in this room and I wasn't expecting, my response is going to be 10 times bigger than anyone sitting next to me. It's just how I am. I'm wired that way. I was trained into that in certain ways. And I believe I have drastically lowered my baseline, like my stress level and my anxiety level has come down at baseline.
Yeah.
And my baseline is really sensitive. And that just, it is what it is. Like, it doesn't work for me to constantly be battling against that and being frustrated with, oh my gosh, one day of moving too quickly through my meetings and already my body is talking to me. Like, having that kind of resistance just doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel, I can go in a downward spiral pretty quickly around that. Just so much frustration. So it helps me to just accept like that my body has my back quickly, profoundly, and sensitively. And that's how I am. I just need to listen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right, for people listening, for some people, that's incredibly empowering to know. Yeah, I can just thank my nervous system for sending me a message that this was startling, or life is a little bit hard right now. And instead of responding with self-judgment of like, I cannot believe I am in a flare up right now. Like, how dare I? I have done years of work. And so, yeah, I can see how it would be empowering to say, yeah, I'm human and I live in a broken world. And of course I'm going to have reactions in my nervous system to things that are happening. Well, also, I just want to take note of the hope that you're talking about, though, which is that threshold, we're not talking about staying in a place of hypervigilance and constantly protecting ourselves because we are in danger. We are safe.
Mm-hmm.
And we can lower that to our standard is that we're safe. And sometimes our nervous system says, oh, am I?
Yeah.
You know?
Sure?
Yeah.
Double checking.
Yeah. Let's confirm that.
That's a hugely important qualifier. I think there is a massive difference between being in chronic pain when you can't make much of your symptoms. They're not rising and falling in a way that helps you develop insight. You can't listen to a bunch of noise. It's just too much. When your pain is all the time, all you can gain from that is my anxiety is through the roof. My stress is through the roof. I need to work on reappraising all of this.
Yeah.
When you're out of that chronic loop, for me, I'm out of the chronic loop. If I have rises and falls, if my body starts talking to me, I can make something of that because my baseline is now quiet.
Yes.
So when the murmur starts, I go, oh, there has been a change. My attention is now being directed to whatever the heck needs my focus or attention, or maybe me, I just need my focus or attention.
Yeah.
And I think those things are really, really different.
It's I don't know why, but the picture is coming up for me of if you're out to a group dinner and like everybody starts talking to you at the same time and you're like, I didn't hear anybody because you're all talking. whereas when you're sitting down with a friend and they have something to say, you can hear when they start talking. And I think that's how I picture what you're talking about is being able to get the message.
Analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Okay. So at what point in time did you start working with Alan Gordon, Howard Schubiner around pain reprocessing therapy, the Boulder back pain study? Let's dive into that. I have had a lot of people on this show, including like Howard Schubiner and I don't know, not Alan, but I actually don't think we've talked about the Boulder back pain study on this show. So I would love to hear what you would want listeners to walk away with understanding about that study.
Awesome. Okay. So when I joined along with Alan, the makings of pain reprocessing therapy had been in the works for years, both due to his contributions and many others. Howard's, I mean, we could, Dr. Schubiner's, Mark Lumley, we could draw this all the way back to Sarno and even before that. But the idea of naming it and packaging it as a set of techniques that we call pain reprocessing therapy, that started in about 2017. Okay. So in 2017, 2018, we ran this study out of UC Boulder, out of Tor Wager's lab there under the direction of Yoni Ashar. And we had a chance to take this treatment process that we knew worked because we had been doing it with our patients for in clinical practice for years.
Yeah.
And we sharpened it up and said, this is now a set of techniques that looks like this and progresses like this.
Okay.
We call it pain reprocessing therapy. Let's test it against an open label placebo. It was just essentially saltwater injections into the back and treatment as usual, meaning people did not get any new treatments. They were just doing whatever else they had been doing previous to joining the study. Specific to their back pain. So we, pain reprocessing therapy can be used for any sensation in any part of the body that you are considering to be neural circuit in nature. For the purpose of a randomized controlled trial, we're going to limit it to back pain.
Yeah.
So there are 150 people in the study at large. About 50 people went into each group, treatment as usual, placebo, and the pain reprocessing therapy group. For the 50 people who ended up in pain reprocessing therapy, they got 9 one-on-one sessions. The first session was with Howard Schubiner. So Dr. Schubiner's role was making sure that the people enrolling in our study had the type of back pain that we were going to treat. So we're ruling out anything that's massively wrong with the back, a structural problem, a pathological problem, something that should have been treated medically long ago. I think out of I think there were like 53, 55 max people that attempted to come into that were randomized to pain reprocessing therapy group. Only a couple of them met qualifications for structural disorders, which speaks to the prevalence, right? Like yep. if you're just taking 55 people at random, a 50 of them were neural circuit in nature. So it just speaks to just how many people are dealing with this.
So it's interesting because when this study came out, I took it to my mentor, actually, and asked her to help me understand it. Some of the language, some of the more complex language. And mm-hmm. And we got an argument because the way that she interpreted it was that because of that filtering process, that meant that there were no structural abnormalities that were part of the study. Does my clarification make sense? So
yes,
to her, that meant nobody with herniated discs was allowed into the study.
Uh-huh.
Could you just talk about that a little bit?
Oh yeah. We have people with all kinds of findings on their MRIs for sure. We had one client and Alan has written about this in his book that had literally an S curve scoliosis.
Nice.
Like the spine was literally contorted. So what Dr. Schubiner was doing was not saying, if anything shows up on your MRI, you have structural pain and you don't qualify for pain reprocessing therapy. The vast majority of, take the study aside, the vast majority of adults walking through space have normal abnormalities in their spine. By the time people are 30, over 50% of asymptomatic 30-year-olds have disc degeneration. Disc degeneration just means your body is getting older. Like from the, that's true of 100% of people, and we all have disc degeneration.
Yeah.
And same is true for lots of things, right? Like disc protrusions, disc bulges. So there's all kinds of things that came up on the MRI. But what we're looking for is, are those normal abnormalities causal to your pain, or are they incidental findings? Like we have wrinkles on our skin. You can see them. They're abnormalities. We didn't start off with wrinkles,
yeah.
but they don't hurt. They have absolutely nothing to do with what our body is feeling physically.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to segue a little bit here, but it just seems like the right time. What kind of language have you heard doctors use, specifically back doctors, that scare patients scare them into fear that causes pain?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any examples of language that's unhelpful?
Sure. Fragile. Your spine is fragile.
Okay.
Your spine is spine, or we could talk about it. We'll use this as an example of back pain. The scap in any part of the body, fragile, prone to injury.
Okay.
We hear that all the time. You're just prone to injury. Radiating pain is used very frequently inaccurately. The idea of, I found a disc bulge up here, 2-millimeter disc bulge. You have pain way over here. It's just radiating pain from the disc bulge. It's just radiating down there.
Like, okay.
What? No, it has literally nothing to do with the disc bulge. But if you find something in the MRI, and then other things, just like big language around what are actually small incidents. Like a tiny disc bulge doesn't need to be, you don't even need to say that. Like you can note it in the report, but you don't need to make a big deal of, oh my God, this something is bulging out of your spine, or you have your bones are grating on each other. There's a bone on bone problem here.
Yeah.
It's not coming from malice, but there's so many medical providers that are trained to just find, again, it's essentially like a wrinkle on the inside of your body. Like imagine if someone saw a wrinkle on the corner of my eyes and they're like, oh my God, so that's huge. It's like a crater. That must hurt so bad. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just normal.
I love you. Yes. Yeah. There's so much fear mongering around the language, and you're right. It's not, if you don't understand pain neuroscience, then it doesn't hurt to say those things.
Yep.
But when you understand the role of this, I mean, they're basically just scaring you right into pain. Bless their hearts. I want to add to the end of that. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
And that degenerative, I think of all of the words I've heard, the one that's most common and I think scares people. One of the ones that scares people the most is that idea of my spine is degenerating. I have degenerative disc disorder. It's this idea of if I'm in this much pain now and it's just crumbling under, like before my eyes as I age, that word freaks people out and I think is wholly unhelpful.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Okay. Okay. So you've got 50.
Yes. We got 50 people randomized in. Yes.
Yeah.
They get one. It's a screening call with Dr. Schubiner, but it's also an educational call with Dr. Schubiner. So he's helping people understand, hey, there's the brain plays a role in all pain experiences. Here's what I'm seeing in your medical records. Here's what I'm here's the model with which we work. The brain is responsible for creating sensation. The brain has the potential to create any sensation in any part of the body. Your medical record is clear. This is where we're going here. You're going to be linked up with either Alan or Christy, me. So Alan and I were the treating psychotherapists. He did sort of a warm handoff to us. And for those 50 people, we met, the clients met with either Alan or myself 8 times over the course of 4 weeks. So we met with them twice a week for 50-minute sessions doing psychotherapy, doing a very targeted form of psychotherapy where we are educating them about the brain-based nature of pain, helping them gather evidence to understand this model as it specifically applies to their case, helping them cognitively understand and conceptualize their pain differently from there's something wrong to my body to my body is adaptive and resilient. There's sensations that I'm feeling that are non-dangerous and safe. Helping them to physiologically respond to their sensations differently through the use of meditative techniques like somatic tracking, where we're bringing their attention to the fear-inducing stimuli of their pain and working to down-regulate their nervous system at the same time. Doing a little bit of work around helping them address any other sort of emotional threats in their periphery that might be leading to the upregulation of their nervous system, which contributes to higher pain levels.
Oh, so you did touch on the emotional components of that. So I assume you're talking about protective personality traits and self-pressure and that type of thing.
Yes.
Okay.
We were limited in that we had 8 sessions.
Yeah.
But the bridge is pretty clear when you get someone's focus like that twice a week for 4 weeks, and we're having so many conversations around threat and perceived threat.
Yeah.
The way that the brain has no ability to distinguish the difference between real threat and perceived threat. And we have a really strong reaction to both of them. And we don't have any ability to gauge in the moment, like our body responds quickly. We don't have the ability to distinguish between psychological, emotional threat and physical threat. Like pain is the output, no matter what sort of threat is input.
Right.
There's a pretty clear bridge over to, well, what else in your surroundings, in your environment might be offsetting these danger signals. So we did get to touch on it.
Okay.
And interestingly, and kind of hopefully, I think when we think about needing to get this treatment to literally millions of people and not everyone in the world has resources for years of psychotherapy, it was not something we camped out on for very long. I mean, we only had 8 sessions with them and we had to start square one. So yes, we talked about emotions, but a lot of it is teaching people the model, teaching them to understand when you're perceiving information in this way, if through a threatening lens, when whatever it is, again, in your periphery, if it's a mother-in-law that you're scaring you, or you have difficulty drawing a boundary with, or if it is your work environment that's incredibly stressful, or fill in the blank, if you can teach them the framework of when threat is being input, pain is the output, the hope is that they're able to also take that framework and use it on their own.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. Okay. That lends to a question that I wanted to ask and you're kind of answering, but let's just get more pinpointed. Mm-hmm. What is the difference? How do you see yourself different than a psychotherapist that is helping somebody work through emotional parts of their lives? So somebody comes to you, or they go to just a psychotherapist. What's the difference between those two things? And part of the reason I'm asking this question is for people who are listening, what should they be looking for if they're looking for some therapy one-on-one?
Yeah.
What are they looking for if they also have symptoms, chronic symptoms?
Great question. So I want to know how things work. I think a lot of people are comforted by understanding, why are we taught, why are we working on this right now in treatment? As I think I had this experience as a chronic pain patient. I went to some therapist who said they specialize in chronic pain. She never brought it up. Why? She was like, oh, your neck hurts. Okay, what happened? What was your childhood like? But there was no connection. I would tell her a story about what happened when I was 8 years old. And I would leave the room being like, is that just supposed to kind of by osmosis start impacting my pain levels? And there is absolutely something to be said about getting an emotional shape. The way there is a way of reducing your anxiety levels that can have a positive effect on your pain level. So it's not for nothing when people do more general emotional processing work in therapy. But I like to know how things work. So pain reprocessing therapy is a clear framework for understanding how we perceive threat and essentially the world around us, in addition to how we perceive sensation. So the backbone of this treatment says, there are sensations in your body that you had previously been perceiving as dangerous. Pain means something's wrong. I need to get treatment. I need to rest. I need to ice. And you're shifting to pain is a sensation that feels dangerous, but it's actually safe. I can think about it in comforting terms. I conceptualize my body as strong, and I can respond to the sensation in a down-regulating way. I don't need to avoid that sensation. I can explore it all I want.
Yeah.
And that same framework is used to process any other fear-inducing stimuli. So if you are afraid of the emotion of sadness, then we're going to talk about an example of a situation that made you sad, or we're going to understand the context for which you developed your fear of sadness. We're going to notice how your body responds when sadness starts to come on. Does it lock up? Does your pain kick up? Do you start feeling fluttery? Do you start just kind of numbing out? And then we're going to help you attend to that sense, that whatever sensation is coming up for you in the experience of that emotion, we're going to help you experience that as safe. We're going to move you towards it. We're going to explore it the same way that we explored your pain sensation. No more avoidance, no more fear. We're going to help you reappraise all of these things, the sensations inside your body as safe and non-threatening, and as many things as we can help you appraise outside of your body as safer, or non-threatening or less threatening.
Mm-hmm. Love it. So if you're going to a traditional therapist, you're going to talk through each one of those detailed scenarios, and it's dragged out and becomes a long process.
Yeah.
When we can learn the framework, basically it empowers us to do a lot of this work with a broad stroke, right? Like we get to understand it in a big picture way that just really empowers us to move forward in those detailed ways without having to do all these sessions. Is that fair?
I'd say the way that you describe that is perfect. And I love what you're saying around it's a broad stroke. It might not be easy, but it simplifies it considerably.
Yeah. It is not easy. Mm-hmm. You are, and I want to just come on record agreeing with you. It is so empowering to have those tools and to understand how it works. But just because you have the tools doesn't mean that you don't have to use them and do the work.
Absolutely.
Very challenging.
And just because you have massively for so many reasons, not the least of which is there are times in your life where the situation around you is threatening. There are times where you're in a pinch, or there are identities of humans who walk through the world feeling more unsafe than other identities of humans, right? Like I'm a white person, I'm a white woman. There's some stuff that comes with that. There's some privilege, there's some safety, and there's also some threat. And that can iterate in a million different ways in terms of how we walk through space. So the way that we're perceiving the world around us, we have some ownership of it, and that can feel really empowering. The way I'm taking in information, I want to learn, no matter what's coming at me, to have a sense of safety in my body. It's like really internalize that sense of empowerment. But not everyone is up against the same threat level. So either situationally, circumstantially, that might be shifting, or it could have to do with who you are and how the world perceives you and your identity. So just want to mention that as well as a legitimate and sometimes very difficult barrier. That a lot of this treatment is about internalizing your sense of safety. There's a lot that happens when you leave the therapy room.
Yeah. There's just this balance of strength and empowerment of realizing this is perceived threat and not I'm not actually in danger. And there's also this gentleness that of which we treat ourselves of, but yes, wow, mm-hmm. there is some things in life that is really difficult and maybe things that I'm perceiving are real. And doesn't mean I have to react in danger, but I can be gentle with myself and recognize this is difficult. And that treating ourselves with grace in those moments, kind of that you're talking about specifically mm-hmm. an example. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Where are we?
I can kind of wrap up where the study landed us, what
Great.
We found out.
Let's do that.
So by the end of those 8 weeks, excuse me, 8 sessions, it's only 4 weeks, which is crazy.
Yeah.
98% of the participants randomized into pain reprocessing therapy improved their pain scores, reduced their pain scores, and 66% of them were pain-free or virtually pain-free. So people who started with all different bodies, all different things, quote unquote, wrong with those bodies, all different lengths of time that they were in pain. I believe the average length that the person was in pain was 11 years. Okay. By the end of those 4 weeks, 66% of them were just out of pain. And those results held after a year. And that was compared to 20% of people who 66% were pain-free in the PRT group, those 20% in the placebo injection group, and 10% in the treatment as usual group.
Okay. Interesting. Which the treatment as usual group may have a little bit of placebo effect, right? In that one too.
Yeah, right. Right. And there was really no regulation on what they were doing. Like some of those people might have been getting some form of something useful. It was just they could do whatever they were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. Okay, so hopefully that's hope for a lot of people listening who, well, it's not, the thing is that study is not just for people with back pain, but it is, mm-hmm. like you were saying, but it is encouraging for people with back pain because we always want to hear about our own symptoms, you know?
Yeah, it can be generalized for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I forgot to mention this to you before we started, but I did ask my listeners if they had any questions for you. And I asked like last night, so they didn't have very much time, but I got two questions and a comment, and I do kind of want to prioritize those. I know I had another question that we talked about, but I want to put a pin in that if that's all right. And
of course,
the question first. Well, the first one was just a comment. And the person wrote in all caps, "I love her."
Wow. I love that person right back.
I know.
That's the kind of type I need on a Friday.
It's funny because I loved her back too. Like I was like, yes.
<That's> I don't know.
It just was really sweet.
Great.
Okay. And here's the other two questions. So first one is, what are the three best practices to incorporate on a regular basis for pain-free maintenance? And is it necessarily to do them daily? I had a mild flare up and started asking myself if there's anything to trouble me. There was a couple minor irritations. How can we affect what's happening at the subconscious level? There's a lot of questions in there, but.
Yeah, those are great questions. And I'm happy to think of my kind of top three top maintenance pick tips that I still use.
Yeah.
This is overstated and overshared for a reason. If you don't have some sort of meditative practice, I highly encourage you that you find one. And that does not need to look the same for all people. If you like mindfulness meditation where you're focusing on your breath for 10 minutes, amazing. If you like taking a walk in a mindful way where you keep bringing yourself back over and over and over to sights and sounds and smells of your walk, that's a meditative practice. If you love somatic tracking, you just can't get enough of it, and you want to keep using that even after you're out of pain, wonderful. But the body, in my opinion, needs to be brought in some way that helps you build connection and create like a safe pocket within you. And if in the absence of that, I think all of this is much more difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
So that would be my first suggestion. Secondly, and this can also be done in a lot of different ways. We don't want to lose the thread in terms of where your mind is going throughout the day. So once you're out of the throes of chronic pain, you've done a lot of work to help bring your brain away from pain-specific fear thoughts. So we're getting you out of that rumination around what's happening in my body and how is this going to interrupt my day and what do I need to do to make it through that meeting or that date or whatever. But your brain is still going to have a tendency to go certain directions. Like if you have a tendency to go towards worry, or if you have a tendency to go towards intensity or pressure or criticism, like we don't want to lose our awareness of that. And yeah. A simple, really simple way of maintaining your awareness is a couple of times a day. You can just build this into your morning or your evening. You can do it at lunchtime. It doesn't matter. Is stopping and literally asking yourself, Where has my mind gone? And just noticing, like in moments of stillness and notice moments of quiet, where has my mind been? Like where have I been? Where have I been living today? Because whatever we're telling ourselves all day is impacting how we're feeling all the time. So when you get out of treatment, it's easy to just let the chatter resume and to lose that sort of analysis and awareness of where your brain is going. But we don't want you to lose that. So check in with yourself a couple times a day is great. If you can do this at the top of every hour, or like just start working in an awareness, it's even better. Just checking in, like, where is my mind? Where is my mind going? Where have I been the past hour mentally?
I like that question. I tend to ask myself, how are you doing? I think that's more at like I think that gets at a heart level, and your question gets at a thought level too, which those things are definitely linked. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna steal that one. I like it.
Good. And then this is I make a personal push for prioritizing the start of your day and having slowness at the start of your day. If your nervous system resets in some ways overnight, we have a chance to input some data within that first 30 minutes or so. Yeah. So I suggest not using. We make a push for not using your phone in the first 30 minutes, or your computer or whatever tablet is sort of rushing you with information. Yeah. And helping set up your nervous system for the day by creating a slow and comfortable pace for the first 30 minutes. I think one of the worst things that we can do for our nervous system is start our day from a place of rush, like immediately offsetting your anxiety. When we feel like we're behind, our nervous system is going to start rushing internally because it feels like you're running from threat and you're not winning. The threat's coming from behind you. So I make a big push for comfortable mornings.
Yeah. I cannot agree with you more. People think I'm crazy, but in the middle of my healing journey, I decided to write down 10 things I didn't like that other people like, and thought I'm going to work toward 3 of them. And one of them was mornings. I didn't like mornings. Yeah. And so because I didn't like mornings and I didn't like getting up for many reasons, I left myself 12 minutes to get out of the house. And that included making my coffee. And I did it and I was good at it. And I was on time to work, you know? But I was dysregulated and stressed. And so in learning to like my mornings included getting up earlier and having quiet time for me that's with God and enjoying my coffee, like sitting at my kitchen counter, you know? And so I just agree with Christy. Yes.
That's so cool that you set up an actual established practice towards the goal. And how neat to hear that your preference actually changed, that you became in some ways like a morning person.
Well, I was like, oh, well, if neuroplasticity is a thing and my brain can perceive danger, it can also perceive to like things. And I have way more power over making my life enjoyable than I've ever been taught.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So it definitely, I don't know, it just changed. There's so many things in our lives that we have to do on a daily basis. And if we can choose to be present in them and enjoy them, like it's just helpful for our bodies and
everything. Yeah.
Okay. So those are your 3. Did you have any other comments about the questions that were part of that first question?
Can you remind me of some of the other pieces if I didn't address them?
Yeah. Let's see. What are the 3 best practices to incorporate on a regular basis? We did that. Is it necessary to do them daily?
I had a mild flare up. I started asking myself if there's anything troubling me. There were a couple minor irritations. Mm-hmm. How can we affect what's happening at the unconscious or the subconscious level?
Okay. It is not necessary to do these things daily as a rigid rule, but the more you're in practice with yourself, the more you're going to want to do them because you're going to notice the absence of them makes you feel badly. So there's a kind of a running start that you need in the beginning. Anytime you're developing any new habit, like if you're out of shape physically and you're like, I want to start speed walking or what have you, those first few attempts, you're like, I didn't like that. That does not feel good. I do not want to do it again tomorrow. But once you're in the practice of it, then you're getting the benefits of it. So you're drawn to do it more. Anytime we're being rigid with ourselves, we're trending back towards that intensity. So listen to your body. If for whatever reason you can't or don't want to or don't feel well enough to, of course, absolutely skip the day. That's how you're meeting your safety needs, is by the rest. And then maybe you'll be feeling better enough tomorrow. In terms of the keeping track of stuff in your unconscious, you're in good company. None of us know what's going on in our unconscious. So that's perfectly normal. But the more that you stay in touch with how your body is somatically feeling, and the more that you develop an awareness of where your brain is going throughout the day, somewhere in between those things, where your mind is going, what your body is doing, is the impact of everything that's in our unconscious. So take a little bit of the pressure off of knowing what you were blind to and put the focus on committing to the impacts of that in how your, where your mind is going and how your body is feeling.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Pay attention to what we can be aware of instead of digging for the thing that we have no ability to find. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question.
Yeah.
Since learning about mind-body syndrome and the impacts of fear and emotions, I feel like I feel like I'm afraid of fear, stress, and worry, and it's prolonging my symptoms. How can I better balance understanding the psychological contributors to my symptoms without getting, quote, in my head about them and worrying about whether the stressful situations coming up will cause a flare, whether I'm fearing too much, et cetera? So fear of fear.
Fear of fear. Well, yeah, that's the spiral.
Yeah.
I relate to it well. I want to give my long answer. It's not too long.
Okay.
I think humans in general have a preference for a known threat as opposed to an unknown threat. So if I were to tell you right now, there's something in your space, which by the way, is beautiful. I have been very calm the whole time looking at your little physical space that you're in. If I were to tell you, there's something in there that could really severely harm you. And then I zip my weapon. I tell you, it's a totally unknown threat. What would you do? Where would you start? Is it something in the air? Is it something on the ground? Is someone going to rush in and harm me? Is it expired food in my lunchbox? How can I make a plan? How can I army up if I have no idea what the threat is? Versus, there's a very tiny poisonous spider on the upper right quadrant of your back window. I wouldn't be super jazzed about the spider, but I would be able to make a plan to keep myself safe.
Yeah.
I think zero people would choose the unknown threat. What would you do? How do you prepare yourself? It's extremely unsettling to not know where the threat is. Anytime our danger system goes off, the first thing our brain wants to do is understand what the problem is so that you can move towards safety. Why do I bring this up? I want to be very clear. No one wants to be in pain. Pain sucks. You and I both know this. It takes over your life and your brain. We do not create it. We are not at fault for it. Most of the time, we are extremely motivated to get out of it. And there is something biologically attractive to the known threat of neural circuit pain. You can draw a box around all of the thoughts that come up as it relates to pain and your recovery. Like this person is saying, it's a never-ending pool of worry thoughts. You're afraid of the fear, and then you're afraid of the fact that you can't get rid of your fear of the fear, and then you're critical of that, and then you're bounce, 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 bounce. All day long, you can spend bouncing your brain around this problem of neural circuit pain. And I'm not saying that's comfortable. In fact, it's incredibly uncomfortable, both physically and mentally. But on a biological level, we are going to be drawn to that over allowing our brain to leave that contained box and start bouncing around all the other uncertainties of our lives, our environment, and the world around us. Things we both know about and we don't know about. Again, our unconscious has tons of uncertainties. We literally don't know what's back there. And then life, living life on Earth, comes with tons of uncertainties. Yeah. So there is something that we prefer to that contained threat. What we can do about that on a day-to-day basis is helping ourselves better understand the mechanism with which our brain pulls us into that box, and then practicing this idea of, it is possible for me to tolerate the unknown. It is possible for me to sit in this moment of uncertainty. It's possible for me to redirect my brain back towards, again, away from that box of pain-related thoughts and see what comes up for me next. I can tolerate that. I can tolerate the broader fear. I can tolerate the broader uncertainty. I can tolerate the broader emotions or emotional conflicts. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a lot of work we can do within the box. You can practice somatic tracking. You can breathe. You can notice your fear thoughts as they pop up and redirect. You can lean into positive sensations. You can lean into positive relationships in your life. And you shouldn't stop doing those things. Those are important techniques. But that question to me speaks to, the spiral is so strong and I can't stop the spiral. I want to encourage that person to think about, maybe there's a reason the spiral is so strong. And maybe some of the work that I need to do is practicing tolerating my fear outside of the pain-related box.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that we're moving from that space of being stuck in that fear cycle to saying, okay, I'm going to take the leap of faith that I am empowered enough to start the process of looking at the source of what is really sending my brain into that first cycle of fear.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put on this bravery and this courage and, mm-hmm. and weather this storm for a minute and see what it's like.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. That's described quite beautifully. It's scary to do, of course, but it's possible in a lot of ways. It's necessary. The way that we're showing up towards our symptoms is generally the way that we're showing up towards life and all of its uncertainties. And again, it's not to minimize the importance of pain-specific tools. They are important, but just something to think about, that as awful as it is, the box, the containment that not only pain, but pain's recovery can provide for a person going through it in some way, like, we appreciate being contained, even if we're stuck in an uncomfortable space.
We appreciate it because it's comfortable,
but no, they're very familiar.
Yeah, but it's not the way out.
Absolutely. It's quite literally the way to be in.
Okay. We were gonna talk a little bit about that very subject of outside of PRT, but our time is getting close to up, so. Just kind of I feel like ending in that arena though. Can we talk? One question that I get a lot, or I hear a lot, is people saying, "I'm just not very emotionally aware," so they've come to realize, okay, yeah, this is probably TMS. This is mind body syndrome, neural circuit pain. But I'm unaware. I don't know. I see the symptom here, and maybe their threshold is still up here, right? Like when it's down here, it's so much easier to hear that one message. But when we're up here, it can be, if we're not emotionally aware, it can be difficult. So do you have any, tips or ways that you help people to start that process of identifying some of those voices that we're hearing at that really loud dinner?
Yes. Yes. So this is where one-on-one or group recovery work, but particularly one-on-one work can be really useful. But I want to give a technique that can be done at home, because I want people from all, no matter what is going on, this is something that you can access. So emotions start out as something that we feel quite naturally. If you think about a baby, they're not clamping down on their emotional states. You think, if I have a 3-year-old, that girl's crazy. She feels everything. The idea of her hiding her feelings would be crazy to her. She feels them very loudly. They're really big. And I love her for that and many other reasons. So we come into this world with an innate sense of connection to our feelings. We learn to send them away. We're taught to send them away.
Yeah.
So that's we don't want to lose sight of that, that our body wants to be in touch with our feelings, and that there's something has come and interrupted that innate connection. And a lot of the times that this presents in session with my clients and in the pain recovery world is the blanket on top of our feelings is nervous system activation. Where our anxiety is so loud, first of all, it's blocking our access to feeling feelings physically. My friend Daniel Lyman always says feelings are called feelings, not thinkings. We can feel them. But if our anxiety is really strong and we have a ton of tension or a ton of pain, or just that like awful fluttery anxiety feeling coursing through our veins, the anxiety is blocking our access to feeling the emotion underneath it.
Yeah.
And then anxious thoughts are so loud that there's no room for emotional. There's no room for emotions. There's no room for that to come up because the anxiety is so loud. So the best way to allow yourself to get back in touch with what you're feeling naturally is bringing your anxiety level down. Because when your anxiety level drops, you don't have to think about emotions coming up. I've had this happen in sessions a million times, that we can downregulate someone, tears just start falling. And this is someone who would tell me, I haven't cried in a decade. Their sadness is totally scary. I don't feel sad. I don't know. It just, when the anxiety comes down, the tears start flowing naturally. You're not trying.
Right.
So you can literally practice this. You can find a safe place in your environment, on your couch, in your bed. You can sit, you can lie down, close your eyes, and practice calming your body for 10 minutes. And again, this can look a lot of different ways. If you don't know where to start, YouTube a mindfulness meditation. Do something to bring your awareness to your body, to your breath for about 10 minutes. Once your anxiety has come down a little bit, then call to mind something that either you know is upsetting you, upset, any type of emotional charge. It can be anger, it can be sadness, it can be disappointment. Or if you don't even know that, if you're like, I don't know, I feel totally unaffected, call to mind something that you think one might be affected by, like you maybe should have been affected by. And you don't need to start with your 10 out of 10s. You don't need to start with the worst thing. In fact, I encourage you that you do not do that. Yeah. You can start with something way like more of a murmur of an emotional experience and just call that situation to mind. And then once you've called it into your mind, bring your awareness back into your body. Feelings are meant to be felt. Start at the top of your head, slow body scan of awareness all the way down to your feet to just ask yourself, am I feeling anything right now? And you do not need to say, yes, it's sadness, there are tears, or yes, it's anger. I'm labeling it anger. And it makes me want to do something with the anger. No, just actually notice, do I have a felt physical sensation right now? We can worry about the labeling later. Sadness is often felt as like a heaviness behind the eyes or heaviness in your chest. Anger is often felt as like a heat that's rising or coming down your arms. You don't even need to worry about that yet. Just see if you can have a connection, a physical connection to whatever the emotional experience was that you drew to mind. You can run through that. You can start back at the top and run through this 3 times. You don't need to meditate again for a full 10 minutes if you don't have that much time to spare, but do another wash. Go back and say, okay, I'm going to come back to my breath for 2 minutes, calm my system back down, bring the emotional experience to the top of your mind, body scan your way through and check for the feeling. Don't worry about labeling, just I always say the ask is the task. So if you are asking yourself, what am I noticing? Is this affecting me in any way? You're already winning. Don't worry about the labeling. Don't worry if you don't even feel anything. The first time you might not. You can practice again tomorrow. So the ask is the task. Asking yourself, how am I affected by this experience? What's going on for me right now?
Yeah. People often get confused between paying attention to how they feel emotions show up in their body, and they just gravitate towards the pain, right? So, so all of a sudden you're trying to find an emotional, you know, where, let's say sorrow. You're trying to find if you have an emotional reaction to something, and all you can see is that that symptom. And I think if I'm understanding you correctly, that's you use the example of anxiety as a symptom, and we're moving past it. So we're doing the deregulation in order to move past that anxiety, so that we're not blocked by it. But that, I guess what I am saying is this is true of pain too, right? Like we're looking at the symptom of pain. We got to calm down a little bit, get our, try to get our nervous system regulated a little bit. So would you say if somebody is in, let's say an 8 or a 9 and they're of their symptom level and, they're wanting to figure out what's happening emotionally. Is that a good time at that high of a number to do this type of a process, or do you feel like it's better to do it at a point where you can move that needle a little bit on your symptoms?
That's a great question. I think it is significantly better to do it at a time when the intensity of your pain is lower or your activation around the intensity of your pain is lower. I don't even ask my clients to have an inward focus very much when they're in that much pain, even if they are 100% confident. My pain is neural circuit. I'm not technically afraid of the source of the symptom. When your pain level is that high, it's nearly biologically impossible to have an intentional focus on it without your nervous system upregulating. So the first task for that person, and again, there's lots of people in this situation. This does not mean it's hopeless by any means. You're in sort of the bulk of the people that I see anyway. If you fit in that category of, I'm not ready for that, my pain is so high, we're not there quite yet then. Our first step, again, is that down regulation, getting your fear level down around the pain, which will eventually bring the pain level itself down. Then we can take a look at the emotional stuff. And there's no rush. We have to do these things in the order that makes sense with our bodies. And that's not wrong or bad. And there's a patience there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We've talked about a lot of things. We've talked about, we've talked about just pressure and how much pressure we get from culture and how that internalizes into our system. We've talked about pain neuroscience education, PRT, and how that's so important, especially when we're looking at normal abnormalities. Beyond that, downregulating and emotionally feeling, like not thinking your feelings, like you were saying, feeling your feelings. Anything else? I have two questions for you. One, anything else you want to say? And then where can people find you? I'm going to put all your info in the show notes, stuff like that.
Only other thing I want to say is for anyone who's listening to this, I'm assuming that they're committed to their recovery. And if at any part, anything we said felt frustrating, like I can't access that yet, or I tried that and it hasn't worked for me yet, we often in the recovery world speak to the ideal situation. Even PRT at large is kind of packaged in a way that we can make it make sense to the masses. It is very normal to have individualized barriers and speed bumps, and to spend a month on a step that another person spent 2 seconds on. I just can't say that enough, that people put a lot of pressure on themselves to self-recover from chronic pain. It's amazing that we have resources out there to help us do that. And it's very difficult to be your own teacher and be the student at the same time. So
yeah,
just keep at it. Just keep at it. And know there is no one look of recovery. There's no one pace of recovery. And if you're listening to this, you're probably one of the people who needs a little bit of extra care in terms of your relationship to fear. And you can have feelings around that. You have feelings around that. You don't have to be completely at peace with it, but I want you to know that it's normal and your hopefulness should not be impacted by the pace at which you're recovering.
That's so good. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. We need to be seen in that space. Yeah.
Big time. And then people can find me. I'd love to connect. People have questions about what we talked about, or if you want to reach out. My team is called Better Mind Center. You can find us at bettermindcenter.com. And then I'm on Instagram at better.with.christy, better with Christy.
Okay. And do you, if people schedule with you, do they do one-on-one sessions? Are you taking clients mm-hmm. right now? Okay.
Currently, I am transitioning away from taking on new clients myself. I'm doing more research and training.
Oh.
The big reason why I have so much trust in the team. So everyone works from the same model. I would spend another hour and a half just talking about how obsessed I am with the people on my team. They're so great. So there are ways to access, there's plenty of ways to access one-on-one help through this model, even if I'm not taking new clients myself.
Okay. Yeah. And you have a beautiful website, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right, y'all, that's it for today. As always, I hope that with every episode, you felt inspired in some way or learned something new and insightful or practical to implement into your healing journey. Now that you are done listening, go outside, do something fun for yourself today, and until next time, make this whole week so great. I had to fight.